Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All Things Therapy with Lisa Tahir, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to All Things Therapy. I'm your host, Lisa Tahir. I want to thank you for joining my guest and I today. This is episode 171. If you don't know me, I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I practice as an intuitive psychotherapist. I have offices in both Los Angeles and New Orleans, as well as I conduct phone, Skype, and FaceTime sessions with clients worldwide. I'd love for you to reach out to me if you're interested in working together. My website is nolatherapy.com. It's the abbreviation for New Orleans, Los Angeles Therapy. You can also find me on social media through Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube at Nola Therapy. And I would love if you join my email list. I have my first book coming out in 2020 with Inner Traditions. The topic has to do with healing our core wounds through empathy and self-forgiveness based on the astrological placement of Chiron in your birth chart. So if you go to that link to join my email list, I'll be able to reach out to you at the right time before my book comes out. Okay, my guest today, I am so excited because in just a few minutes, we are going to be with David Ritz. David is a Grammy Award winner. He is a New York Times bestselling author. His career spans 50 years. If you're at a computer and want to jump on the web, his website is Ritz. RitzWrites.com. And David is a songwriter. He has collaborated with artists such as Janet Jackson. He co-wrote Sexual Healing with Marvin Gaye. David has authored, co-authored, and ghostwritten 55 biographies, autobiographies, and numerous articles with music's most inspirational artists. And this is an abbreviated list of those that he has worked with. Ray Charles, Marvin Gaye, Smokey Robinson, B.B. King, Aretha Franklin, Etta James, Jerry Wexler, Grandmaster Flash, Buddy Guy, the Neville Brothers, Willie Nelson, Janet Jackson, Lenny Kravitz, Michael Jackson, and Rick James. Today, we are discussing his memoir titled The God Groove, A Blues Journey to Faith, where David very openly and authentically shares his own journey of faith from being raised Jewish to finding and embracing Christianity over many years of his writing and time spent with these artists that I list, and really feeling and experiencing the divine, experiencing the love of God through this music. He chronicles his journey of recovery from addictions that we'll discuss, his 50-year marriage to his wife, Roberta, navigating his fluid sexual orientation, and that just really bedrock of a strong relationship. They have two daughters. One's a writer, one's an educator. David has subsequently lost his parents and just is so openly transparent about how all of these experiences have shaped him and his faith. And before David comes on to speak with us, we have a little clip of a song that he co-wrote with Howard Hewitt titled On and On that you're welcome to play at the station.
You were my wife, my life, my hopes and dreams. For you to understand what this means, I shall explain. I stood all the jealousy and all the bitching too. Yes, I.
David, welcome.
Hi.
Hey.
Just before we begin, I just want to say what we heard wasn't the song I wrote with Howard, but was a a gorgeous song written by Marvin Gaye called Just to Keep You Satisfied, which was covered by Howard. But I am, I was extremely happy to hear it because
I love it.
So okay. It was a great kind of error.
Thank you for that. I wanted to set the stage interviewing you. You have such a rich and long history. I wanted to do something different to welcome you.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for being with us. It's really an honor.
All right.
So where would you like to start us on your memoir and this journey of writing about yourself versus writing about other people?
Well, I guess, you know, just before we came on the air, you were asking me whether it was easy or hard, and I was began to talk about how it was easy to do this book. And I think the reason was that it was easy because I didn't have to interview anybody but me. Mm. And I have been interviewing other people, trying to get them to be candid and forthright and introspective about their own life for so many years that by the time it came to me, I kind of knew what to do. And I was also interested in hearing my own voice because when you ghostwrite, which is my main job, when you ghostwrite, you channel a voice which isn't yours, but is yours in that it's coming through you. So that, in other words, let's say you and I both ghostwrite the same person. We have two different ghostwritten versions of the book. Your version will be much different than mine because it'll come through you and mine will come through me. So any and for all these years, I've been channeling voice and intrigued by that process. And I was curious to see what it would be like to hear my own voice. And I was also kind of curious to see how candid I would be and whether I would be scared to reveal certain things about myself.
Yeah.
Or all that kind of stuff. But in the when it happened, I think I wrote the book probably in 2 or 3 months. It just all kind of fell out of me, and I didn't really have any apprehensions. Now, much of that may be due to the fact that I'm old and don't care what people think. I mean, I do care what people think. Everybody cares what people think, but I mean, I'm comfortable, you know, with who I am, and I'm certainly comfortable with talking about my journey, and I thought it was important for me to describe my journey, not only for my children and my grandchildren, but also because there hasn't been lots of books. As a matter of fact, I don't really know of any book about what it's like to be a ghost writer. And
yeah.
I thought maybe it might be helpful for someone who's interested in being a ghost writer. And then there was the other aspect that was important to me to describe, which is my own journey to faith, which is, I think, peculiar or at least sort of different, though everybody's journey is different. And I wanted to see what that would look like on the page. And so, you know, it was kind of a joyful process to write the book. And I didn't really struggle, but I don't usually struggle generally as an author. I write pretty easily and quickly and fluently. And I think it's because my main kind of template is improvisational jazz, so I feel like I'm sort of making it up as I go along, and I'm riffing and I'm making music as opposed to trying to be Ernest Hemingway or Leo Tolstoy. And so the idea of embracing jazz as my template has been extremely, extremely helpful to me. And so I think that's one of the reasons I've been so prolific, is that on one hand, I take my writing very seriously, and on the other hand, I do not, which is to say, it's just another book. It's another solo. There'll be some pretty notes in the solo. You may enjoy it. You may not enjoy it. But I'm not going to agonize over it. And I think lots of authors agonize. I don't. I just sort of let it go. And it'll be what it'll be, and it'll go wherever it goes, and it'll always be imperfect, and that's okay. And so, you know, that's my general attitude.
You know, one of the reasons I was looking forward to interviewing you is because your book, which I found so compelling, I felt as if I was with you in the homes of the artists that you interviewed and often spent years with, and you were so transparent about your reactions to them and their reaction to you and your own parallel process, the way you can write about all the layers of experience that we have going on in a given day and really draw out each line of what's going on with you emotionally, physically, spiritually, sexually, even when they conflict, and then engaging as a husband, as a father, as a writer, and then your own time alone, just all these multidimensional experiences going on at once. As a therapist, I just found it so exciting and just well articulated.
Keep this in mind, and I tell you this as a, I mean, this is me talking to you, the therapist. I've been probably in therapy of one kind or another, beginning at age 10 for my speech impediment. So, I mean, I am really the product of all kinds of psychotherapy, different modalities, some of which I look back and think to myself, you know, was that useful or was that jive? And but it's all good. I mean, in that I've always believed in self-reflection, and I've always can you hold on one second? My dog is barking. I gotta let my dog out. I apologize.
Yeah. It's okay. Those of you listening, thank you for tuning in with us. I'm super stoked to be talking to David Ritz today.
Anyway, we were talking about psychotherapy, and, you know, I used to condemn myself as as being kind of a lifer in psychotherapy and self-reflection as a form of ego or narcissism and all that. But I no longer do that. I mean, I think that kind of self-condemnation isn't very useful, particularly when I see that the big arc of this, the big projection of this story, or the big arc of this story of me in psychotherapy, or me as a self-reflecting person talking to other people about my lives and paying professionals to do so, has led me out of myself rather than further into myself, by which I mean it's been part of the process of bringing me to, you know, what I would call God, or the source of love, or that which is much larger than my own consciousness. And so I'm, you know, I'm kind of grateful to my mom and dad, who were big believers in therapy and encouraged me and had me go early, though it's turned out much differently than I would have ever anticipated.
Yeah. You know, I also enjoyed, David, on this theme of self-discovery, going, being inwardly reflective versus outwardly engaged, yeah, that your own process of authenticity, accepting yourself, and the artists that you wrote about, you know, the various degrees to which they struggled with self-judgment and criticism, and yeah, the use of prayer and spirituality to help mm-hmm. with their mm-hmm. own woundedness. And then for you to find recovery through 12-step programs
yeah.
and community. I just thought that was such a beautifully yeah. laid out arc.
Well, I appreciate that. And yeah. of course, that's a critical component, because I think moving from individual therapy, which of course is a private encounter, the doors closed, you're paying a person $150 or $200 or whatever you're paying him an hour, and they're your employee in a certain sense, they work for you or you're paying them, is one paradigm. But going into a community where there's no money involved, where they're all amateurs in the sense of the word mm-hmm. of amateur being sort of love, is the heart of the matter, and which you have to get up and announce, you know, I'm an alcoholic or a coke addict or a sex addict. Mm-hmm. And getting to talk in an hour meeting for maybe 5 or 6 minutes and having to sit and listen to other people for 55 minutes is a much, much different kind of experience than I had ever had before. And of course, the irony about the 12-step things for me is that, and I'm not an orthodox, I don't really subscribe to fundamentalism or
right
or literalism in any way, but so that, I mean, I don't think you have to work the steps. I think you can work the steps. I think there's a million ways to work the steps. I think you have to ask yourself, what are the steps and all that. So, I mean, I don't believe in the absolute universality of 12-step programs. I think it works for a lot of people. I think it may not work for lots and lots of people. But the point I wanted to make about it was that one of the good things about it was that, you know, you get to call God whatever you want to call God. And though the program was begun by evangelical Christians during the Depression, I didn't really know that until I got into it. And then when I got into it, I read about the origins of AA and saw that it's sort of based on Christian love ethos. And that got me more and more interested in Christianity, which I was interested in anyway because of yes. African-American music. So the two kind of coalesced and took me deeper into what became a Christian devotion. But I've always liked the irony of being drawn to Christianity by a program that refused to use the language of Christianity. In other words, there's no talk of Jesus in the 12 steps. And yet, to me, it's all Jesus, you know? So,
yeah.
And I wouldn't change that. I mean, I think that's one of really, really brilliant parts of the program, that they don't insist upon specific lexicon. And in the very same way, I don't think the word Jesus is for everybody. I mean, some people come to it with a history that's going to prevent them from ever embracing the word. And so that's not very important to me. I mean, what is important is, you know, what is the spirit, you know, of Christ. And if you embrace that spirit, you are embracing that spirit. And if you want to call it glue or wood or overcoat, I don't care. So anyway.
You know, I see the spirit of Christ in most traditions to come down to forgiveness and, mm-hmm. and atonement. And one of my favorite sections of your book is when you were with Etta James and she would often pray with you and even her relationship to God, like, God, you know, I'm taking these pills I don't need. And it's her relationship was so close to spirit. Yeah. And how as open as you are in your writing, in your book about sex addiction, about drug addiction, the one thing that was the hardest until the end for you to say out loud was that you're a Christian and you wanted to adopt those beliefs. And then Janet Jackson is at your baptism and your wife, Roberta, who I felt like was right there in the narrative. Like, I feel like I know her from your book, was concerned and worried for various reasons. And yet, like, this self-soothing, I think for you always being so ambitious and driven and just taking on these projects that there wasn't a lot of gentleness with yourself. And I see your spirituality kind of gave you that soft landing spot in unconditional love.
I appreciate that. I haven't really thought about it that way. But now that you mentioned it to me, that kind of helps me. I like that idea.
Awesome.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
I think that the fear of calling oneself a Christian, or at least the fear with me, was, you know, pretty much cultural, because I'm, you know, extremely Jewish. I'm proud of being Jewish. My dad was, you know, Jewish and intellectual, and comes out of a very strong Jewish intellectual tradition. You know, I think I'm part of that tradition, and I have great identification with, you know, Jewish authors and Jewish humor and the whole thing. And so the Christ business is always kind of creepy, and mm-hmm. Jesus is always creepy, and getting past all that, of course, it took me a long, you know, I was baptized when I was 60 years old. So, I mean, it took those many years to embrace what I thought was a gospel of love. But had, as you had said before, had I not encountered these author, these stars and musicians, I don't think I could have gotten there, because the nature of my job, and that's the other beautiful thing about being a ghost writer. If you're just an author, I mean, I don't mean just an author. It's great being an author, and there's a jillion authors I admire and I learn from all the time. But if you're an author, chances are you aren't spending all your time listening and trying to channel other people. And if you're a ghost, right, that's all you do. And to be good at it, you really have to be quiet, and you really have to elicit intimacy, and you really have to try to get to the heart of the person you're talking to, and you have to show them love and respect. And so you're trying to create an ambience of love. And so that finally, when that's created, when you've created this environment of goodwill and love and trust, and if the person does have religious depth, that's going to come out. Mm-hmm. And when it came out in the form of Etta James or Marvin Gaye or Smokey Robinson or a lot of other people, it got all over me, in other words, because for me to be a good interviewer, I have to interview with my heart. My heart has to be open. It can't be mechanical or perfunctory. Mm-hmm. And so I got to benefit from their faith. And like I said, it got all over me, and I began to understand in real time, without having to struggle with a church or a preacher or an institutionalized religious thing, which has its own challenges, but it was just person to person, I got to see what it is like to believe on a visceral level. And then reinforcing it even greater was my visceral love of the music that began when I was a child.
With your dad going to the clubs.
Yeah. And that always felt to me like more than entertainment. I mean, I call it now a religious experience.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't call it that then, but I sort of now know that going to a concert to hear Billie Holiday was a religious experience, that she was channeling some incredible pain, and she was transforming the pain into beauty, and that transformation of pain into beauty is a godly, divine act. And it just isn't, oh, that sounds good or that feels good. That's transformational. In other words,
it is.
Yeah, I mean, that's going from the human to the divine. And so the older I got and the more I thought about my musical history and my experience of listening to music, the more I understood that I have been groomed or I have been tutored by preachers whose names are, you know, Charlie Parker or Ray Charles or Ella Fitzgerald or whoever. I mean, these were my preachers. They were sort of ministering to me and softening my heart, and because they were vulnerable in the expression of their art form, I was becoming more vulnerable as a human being.
And they saw that within you.
Right. And it took a long time. I mean, because of all the cultural prejudices, you know, that I have, and because of my inclination to identify so closely with my origins, you know, and also I didn't want people to get mad at me. I didn't want my wife or my father or my children to think he's gone crazy, he's become a Christian. And then the other challenging thing became, what kind of Christian am I going to become? And so I spent years reading books on Christianity, and if I read a book in which I felt the author was sort of misguided, I would want to throw out all of Christianity and say, oh, well, this, I can't be a Christian because this guy looks at Christianity like this. Whereas my ultimate conclusion was, there's a lot of ways to embrace Christ, and there's a lot of ways to understand Christ. And a lot of people who call themselves Christians, I don't even see as being Christians. I mean, in my view of Christianity. So that took a long time. And everything in me didn't want to embrace it because of the challenge. I mean, I was also scared that would I be looked at as a proselytizer, which I'm not. I mean, I don't like proselytizing. I think it's often a form of ego. You have to believe what I believe, and I'm not really going to open up my heart to you and listen to you. I'm going to talk to you and tell you what I think and why you should think the way I think, whereas I think our main job as human being is to listen to each other and then figure out, can I offer words that will make any difference to this person? And so I was scared that I would be viewed as a proselytizer. And, you know, I'm not, and I won't be. And I think, if anything, my relationships with my wife and my children and my grandchildren, you know, all of whom are Jewish and continue to practice Judaism, has probably improved, just because I think I might be easier to get along with, or, like you say, I might have found a softer place to land, mm-hmm. and I don't have to pontificate. And I don't like pontifications. I mean, even in the field of my expertise, you know, I try not to pontificate. I just try to be a student. And because the people that I know something about, you know, Marvin Gaye or Ray Charles or Aretha Franklin, there's a whole lot of people in the world who know things about them that I don't know. And they have things to teach me about them. And so, you know, I try to avoid being a sort of know-it-all, which is a form of ego that I find repellent. Though I am scared that I will be that. I mean, I
at 75.
I am still scared, because my dad was pretty much a know-it-all, and I still, you know, part of me still is scared I'm going to turn into him, as much as I loved him. So much about him was repugnant to me, and but I don't think I'm as worried as much about that as I used to be. But there are times when I'll be out and I'll start talking and I'll say, well, that's my dad, just that's the kind of thing he would say, and then I have to pull back and say, well, maybe I'm wrong, or maybe I don't know what I'm saying here, and all that kind of stuff. So
the relationship you had with your dad was so interesting to me. Mm-hmm. You were so close at times, and yet there were moments it was fraught with tension. He was a Marxist atheist who loved music and writing, and he was supportive of you, yet at times critical because you were a ghostwriter.
Right.
And then you were also able to set boundaries with him and take distance when necessary. And in the end, when he passed away, you had that peace. You had that. You know, moment of, to me, like, things are okay. Like, things are as they need to be.
I would only add to that, because this is sort of interesting also. I would add a little bit to it. I can't remember how much of this I put in the book. But when my dad died, he died at 95 and a half, and I was there and spent the last couple weeks with him, and I thought we had everything resolved. And we did talk about, you know, there was a lot of closure. And we had a good relationship the last 20 years of his life. But it still really messed me up. And, mm-hmm. Because, you know, my dad was my heart, for better or for worse. He was just my heart. And when a person takes your heart away, there's anxiety. So, I mean, after his death, I went through a really hard time. I wanted to call him. I wanted to get in touch with him. Because, you know, we talked every other day, and he knew all the details of my life. And so I did go through lots of anxiety attacks, and, you know, finally wound up going to a hypnotherapist to try to chill out. And it was more anxiety than I had ever anticipated. So, you know, I thought I had it covered, but I didn't. And I mean, ultimately, I walked through the fear and the pain. But I think it was also like pretty much like a primal fear, like, you know, your dad is between you and sort of death, and now he's gone, and now it's you and death. And so, he was protective in a certain way in my mm-hmm. life. And
you
so
spoke
losing
about that.
Him.
Yeah.
Losing him was much more powerful, had a much more powerful impact on me than I had ever anticipated.
It was such a significant loss, and the deep grieving that you described going through, even contemplating relapsing after having been sober, you know, that it really put you in touch with your deepest fears, and you did move through them.
Yeah. And of course, that's an important thing, because with the whole relapsing is really about, I can't take this pain. Let me sort of numb it out. Let me anesthetize myself so I don't have to. And what I really had to do was kind of walk through the fear and the pain. And I think that's what we all have to do. And if we don't, if we drink away the fear or we act out away the fear, it doesn't go away. It just goes, you know, it's like dirt under the carpet. You're ultimately going to choke on it. And
that shame cycle comes back.
Yeah. And the same cycle comes back, and the drink or the sexual acting out, it just doesn't work. It just makes things worse. I mean, there's a temporary thrill, which is important, because or else you wouldn't really want to do it. So you are thrilled and you are high. But it's interesting that as I talk, I'm thinking, you know, we use the word high. And what's interesting about high is that you're above where you should be. I mean, in other words, where you should be is in the sort of middle of the mix, the middle of the pain, the middle of the confusion, the middle of the anxiety. And when you're high, you're sort of risen above it. But for a while you think that's great, mm-hmm. because you are high, but then you come down and it's worse
and beating yourself up and the shame and shame
is a huge deal. I mean, shame is a major component of the whole thing, and I think so many of us are addicted to shame, and shame, I think, is toxic. You know, I mean,
I like that aspect. I've been in recovery from cocaine addiction for the last 10 years, and so I related to, for me, it came down to just stop doing what caused me to do things that made me feel so bad. Mm-hmm. And because though it numbed me out in a positive way, it also numbed me out from really good things. Mm-hmm. And to have to live life on life's terms, sometimes it's hard, but I'd rather. Mm-hmm. And I saw you saying that in your own way when you got clean, and now you're able to write 4 and 5 books at a time. I mean, prolific, and be engaged and present, and just the gift you gave yourself through your recovery.
Yeah. Well, cocaine is also, I mean, there was a time when I was hooked on cocaine, and cocaine is I mean, every drug is interesting. It's got its own properties. And I was a pothead as well, and I haven't, you know, had a joint since
1990,
right, the end of January. And again, I'm for the legalization of pot, so I'm not, but I mean, I respect it. I use it, and I'm an addict, so I cannot do it in any sort of moderation. But I do have respect for it. I mean, I think it's got medicinal properties, and it's got a lot to it. And with cocaine, it was different for me. Cocaine, it goes back to what we're talking about being high. I mean, the high of cocaine is so much higher than it is with pot, at least it was for me. But it also seemed to separate me from my soul. And it was such an ego booster, you know, in not a pretty way. Now, it's energizing, and, you know, you can go for hours and hours and hours, but it was all about me, you know, and I'm the greatest, mm-hmm. and I'm this, and the dean, and, you know, so I found it an especially pernicious drug. And am happy that I haven't used it in all these years.
Same here. So, David, what is next for you? Do you see, like, in kind of concluding, where do you go from here? I mean, I was excited and nervous to interview you. You're a master interviewer, but I just told myself, shut up and listen.
Well, I appreciate that. And I am doing what I always do, which is basically continuing my recovery, which is, I think, all about trying to get closer and ultimately uniting with God, you know, embracing God closer and closer and being aware of the fact that, you know, God is in me and God is everywhere and God is everything. So my mystical journey continues, you know, and hopefully that informs my work, and my work continues. And I'm more committed to ghost writing than ever. I mean, I don't want to write a biography, and I have no plans to write another book about myself. And one of the beautiful things about my job is that every new book I do is a new person, so I get to learn about them and hear the music and how they speak and try to look deep into their heart and help them what they cannot do by themselves, which is to write a book. So, you know, I feel a little bit like a shoemaker or a dressmaker. You know, I've learned to make a dress. I've learned to make a pair of shoes. I think I'm good at it. I like the way I write. I like to type. I like to see the words sort of dancing across the screen. So, you know, I just try to, you know, stay healthy and exercise. And because I can't, I'm doing really what I love. And I just want to keep on doing it. And for, in a beautiful way, the people that I'm working with now all have very powerful relationships to God. And though they're, I'm not writing what you would call traditionally religious books, I am dealing with people who, like me, are very involved in their relationship with the Spirit. So that makes me very happy.
Yes.
And so it's a continuation of the God groove. You know, in other words, the God groove is basically the heartbeat. You know, that's the groove that keeps us going. And I feel like I'm still on that groove.
You are. David, thank you for taking your time today. Well, it's been such a pleasure.
I appreciate your taking the time, and thank me for, and thank you for the insight about my soft landing. Remember that every time I get uptight.
You're welcome. That just came very clear to me, giving yourself a soft place to land
okay.
now.
Thank you again.
Okay. You're welcome, David. Take
okay,
care
bye-bye.
And bye-bye. That concludes my show today with David Ritz, author of his memoir, The God Groove, A Blues Journey to Faith. Thank you for joining me, y'all. Be come back next week, and I'll bring you another guest. All my love. Bye-bye.
Indeed, listening is the new reading. With Audible, you can listen to an unlimited amount of books at home, in your car, at the gym, anywhere on the go. With over 180,000 audiobooks to choose from, for you, the listener of All Things Therapy, Audible is offering you a free audiobook download and a month-long subscription for you to try them out. Visit audibletrial.com/allthingstherapy now. And enjoy.
Do you want to help yourself and friends find a purpose in life?
Then you are in the right place and be a part of the crowdfunding campaign of patreon.com/allthingstherapy
with Lisa Tahir as she initiates a one-on-one interaction with inspiring authors, healing experts, and spiritual directors. Join the League of Heroes of this generation by contributing your quota between $1 up to $100 per month at patreon.com/allthingstherapy. And let's make the world free of suicide, poverty, depression, and in all, make the world a better place for everyone.
You're listening to All Things Therapy with Lisa Tahir, only on LA Talk Radio.